Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present independent journalist and author Dar Jamail, who looks at the current spike in violence in Iraq and how the conditions on the ground there could affect the U.S. presidential election campaign. Wilma Subra, a chemist and advisor to the Louisiana Environmental Action Network, who describes the environmental damage resulting from a recent oil spill on the Mississippi River in New Orleans. And Gioni Parker, with Media Matters for America, who takes a critical look at the edits made to a CBS News interview with GOP presidential candidate John McCain that deleted the Arizona senator's embarrassing misstatements of facts. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After a 13-year manhunt, former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic was arrested in Belgrade, Serbia, on charges of war crimes committed during the war over the breakup of Yugoslavia. In Belgrade, Karadzic grew a long white beard, assumed a new identity, practiced alternative medicine, and operated a website. He faces charges of genocide and other war crimes allegedly committed in a massacre of 8,000 Muslim men and boys in 1995 in Srebrenica and for the shelling of civilians in Sarajevo during a 43-month siege. Karadzic's arrest came only 2 weeks after a new pro-Western coalition had taken over the Serbian government and cooperated with European security officials. Former Bosnian Serb General Ratko Mladic, who also faces war crimes charges, is still at large. Many Balkan observers say that Mladic's arrest could provoke more unrest among Serb nationalists than Karadzic's capture did. The surprise arrest of Karadzic will likely pave the way for Serbia's entry to the European Union, which could attract economic development to the region. The arrest also follows Kosovo's declaration of independence in February and a new pro-Western governing alliance that includes what is left of Milosevic's Socialist Party, which has now taken a pro-EU position. The Los Angeles Times reports a federal grand jury has issued subpoenas to the nation's largest subprime lenders, Countrywide Financial, New Century Financial, and IndyMac Federal Bank, which was recently taken over by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The subpoenas are seeking emails, phone bills, and banking records, which indicates a full-scale criminal investigation is underway in Los Angeles, targeting the leading banks in the subprime industry. In recent months, all three banks have been either bought out, seized by federal officials, or have declared bankruptcy. Federal investigators are also looking into special mortgage deals offered by Countrywide to high-profile politicians like Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut, chairman of the powerful Senate Banking Committee. The scale of massive mortgage losses in recent months has the potential, say legal observers, of being the largest financial fraud case since the 1980 savings and loans debacle, which required a full-scale federal takeover of lending institutions under the Resolution Trust Corporation. Prosecutors are trying to determine if stockholders were defrauded by bank executives and if high-level corporate officials engaged in insider trading. Yet legal observers say the federal government will have a difficult time proving fraud against subprime lenders. Many of the financial instruments used were extremely complex, and showing intent to commit fraud will not be easy. Oil and gas industry contributions to John McCain's presidential campaign surged after McCain changed position and endorsed opening up offshore areas of the U.S. coast to oil exploration. According to the Washington Post, oil executives gave McCain $1.1 million in June, the bulk of which came after the GOP candidate's June 16th speech advocating offshore drilling in California and Florida. The pro-drilling stance is part of a Republican strategy appealing to consumers hard-pressed by skyrocketing gasoline prices. David Donnelly, a public campaign who backs public financing of federal elections, noted, "This is a case study of how a candidate can change a policy position in the interest of raising money." Right after his speech on lifting the offshore drilling ban, McCain went on a fundraising tour with Texas oil executives. The campaign raised $1.3 million at a private reception at the San Antonio Country Club. Previously, oil and gas interests had a lower profile among McCain donors. The Arizona senator had been backed mostly by financial services and real estate lobbies. In the Senate, before the current campaign, McCain had opposed the oil industry on opening up public land to oil drilling and on global warming legislation. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
In the worst suicide bomb attack in Iraq in over a month, four suicide bombers struck a Shiite pilgrimage in Baghdad and a Kurdish protest rally in northern Iraq on July 28. The attacks, believed to have been carried out by women, killed at least 57 people and wounded nearly 300. The attack in the northern oil-rich city of Kirkuk targeted Kurdish protesters who were demonstrating their anger at a political deadlock in the national parliament over the scheduling of provincial elections. The Kurds, in control of Iraq's semi-autonomous northern region, are seeking to annex Kirkuk, which has created a backlash among the city's Arab and Turkmen population. Rising tensions between Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army and the U.S.-backed Badr Brigade of the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq could trigger new violence among these powerful Shiite rivals. And while Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki recently endorsed Democratic U.S. presidential candidate Barack Obama's timeline to withdraw U.S. combat troops from Iraq within 16 months of taking office, political instability could dramatically reverse the decline in violence seen in Iraq in recent months. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with independent journalist and author Dar Jamail, who reported from Iraq for 8 months between November 2003 and February 2005. Jamail assesses the success of the surge and how changing conditions on the ground in Iraq could affect the U.S. presidential election campaign.
To create a climate where political reconciliation can occur, that being the goal of the surge. We are further from that today, far, far further from that today than we ever were before the so-called surge was enacted in early 2007. And there's several main things going on, touching on some of them. Keeping the Sunnis consistently as part of the government hasn't really happened. So far, it looks like they've just come back into the government in order to issue huge rebukes against Iraqi President, the Kurd, Jalal Talabani, because of his very undemocratic efforts to basically try to pass through legislation and set the stage so that Kirkuk can essentially secede from the rest of Iraq and become part of a greater independent Kurdistan. The Kurds have been gunning for this from the second the invasion began, and they're closer to realizing it today than ever. But ironically, the closer they get to that, the more we can count on Turkey to apply military pressure. Just yesterday, there were over a dozen airstrikes in northern Iraq in Kurdistan-controlled territory by the Turkish military alone. Other things that we can point to that the surge was theoretically supposed to help and assist and improve, if we look at, again, talking about the lack of reconciliation, a part of the surge, and actually this is something that happened long before the surge even started, was the formation of a U.S.-backed Sunni militia called the Sahwa, or the Awakening Groups. And this is essentially an 80,000-plus strong Sunni militia, all of them being paid about $300 a month of U.S. taxpayer money. According to the military, most of the members are former resistance fighters, and many of them are even al-Qaeda members, keeping in mind they're all on U.S. taxpayer payroll. And this has essentially now created a conflict within Baghdad, parts of Diyala province, parts of Salah ad-Din province, and rampantly throughout Al-Anbar province, where the Sahwa forces are now coming up against the forces represented in the government by the Iraqi dialogue group, where their government forces are now coming into direct conflict with the Sawa forces, because now the Sawa have some muscle to flex. We're talking about a militia between 80 and 100,000 strong that are now demanding political power and political representation, but they're not getting it because other Sunni groups that already have representation in the government don't want to share power. So we're starting to see struggle and already flashes of violence from this struggle throughout Al-Anbar and the other provinces that I mentioned. And then within the Shia, we have also jockeying for position of power between Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi Army militia, which I would vehemently disagree with that New York Times piece claiming that he's lost any power whatsoever. My point is there is a direct conflict now between Sadr and his militia and the U.S.-backed elements of the Shia in the Iraqi government, the Supreme Islamic Iraqi Council, the SAIC group, and their Badr organization militia, where these groups are now vying for power and control of places like Basra, the oil-rich city in the south, parts of Baghdad, et cetera. So really, it's not just between Sunni and Shia and Kurd, but even within each of these sectarian or ethnic groups, we're seeing rising power struggles, many of them already showing signs of violence that I think is only going to continue with time. And this is all a direct or indirect result of U.S. policy on the ground there.
Dar, when you look at the coming U.S. presidential election campaign, how do you think events in Iraq will affect the campaign here? And how do you think the Bush administration's policies will attempt to quell the violence to assist John McCain in the coming months, given that his campaign is predicated on things are better now and that McCain really had the answer with the surge?
Well, I think as the election here approaches in November, we should expect to see, I think, things come unraveled even more and more in Iraq. And I say that specifically because even just talking about Kirkuk, we mentioned that briefly earlier, as November approaches here, that brings us ever closer to Kirkuk and the Kurds trying to wrest Kirkuk away from the government in Baghdad to have greater control of it. Well, not just Arabs in Kirkuk, but even Muqtada al-Sadr and his militiamen, who have a fairly strong presence in that city as well, are going to resist that. And that's all set to happen, I think, likely before November, more so than afterwards. And I think one thing that's clear, you know, when we have a day where, you know, scores of people dead and hundreds wounded, then you can't keep that out of the media. As corrupted as our mainstream media is, when you have these extremely violent, catastrophic type of days in Iraq, and I would expect some more of these certainly between now and the November elections, you can't keep that out of the news. So it will be interesting to see how the McCain camp tries to react to that, who absolutely wants to keep professing, yes, the surge is working, Bush administration policy is working in Iraq, and that's what we're going to keep doing.
That was independent journalist Dar Jamail. Read his articles online at dahr.org. Jamail is the author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. On July 23rd, a ship in the Mississippi River passing through New Orleans rammed an oil barge, cutting it in two and creating the largest oil spill on the lower Mississippi in at least a decade. Almost 400,000 gallons of heavy fuel oil flowed into the river, and the barge continued to leak oil days later as it sat tied up to a pier below the Crescent City Bridge. The river closure has trapped 200 ships around New Orleans, and the oil has contaminated 100 miles of riverbank and marshes between New Orleans and the Gulf of Mexico. Wilma Subra, a native Louisianan, chemist and winner of a MacArthur Genius Award, provides technical assistance to the Louisiana Environmental Action Network. In that capacity, she spent several days examining the spill on the water and from the air to try to determine the extent of damage it caused. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Subra about the nature of the spill, the cleanup efforts, and how this environmental disaster may affect recent efforts to open up offshore areas to oil drilling, which Republican John McCain supports and Democrat Barack Obama opposes.
The oil is a really heavy, thick, like bottom ends of the refining process. It's called fuel oil, a bunker fuel. And it's actually making a sheen, so the lighter portion is floating on the surface, and then it is suspended in huge globules and clumps, like right under the surface. the fear was that most of it would sink to the bottom if they didn't get out there and quickly remove it. So they have put up booms along the banks of the Mississippi River. Like I said, the spill occurred in New Orleans, and it's 100 miles to the Gulf of Mexico. And by Thursday morning, it was already all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. So it had washed up on the shores of the banks of the river, and then they put booms out to capture it. As you go down the river before you get to the marshy areas, there are a large number of oily birds along the banks of the river. The odor is just horrendous all the way down. The human impact, when it was in the New Orleans area where it was when it first leaked, you could smell it like 10, 15 miles back from the river. And it was some of the volatiles, it was some of the hydrogen sulfide, it was making people nauseous and that type of thing. But then as you proceed downriver, closer to the Gulf and closer to the marshes, there are a number of diversion projects that have been put in that actually pump water across the levee and into the marshes. Now, those have been boomed off, but when you go down there, you see that the booms are not really adequately protecting those sources so that some of the diversions are carrying some of the hydrocarbons into the marshy area. And then when you get further down the river where the levees don't exist anymore, it's spreading out into the marshes and all. And that's the area where it's having an impact on the wildlife and on the ecosystem, as well as along the riverbank. The riverbank outside the levee is really called the Batcher, and it, in some places it's 10, 20, 50 feet wide. And that area is out of the water for most of the year except during flood stage. So it has a lot of tree growth. It has a lot of animal life. It has an ecosystem unto its own, and all the batches along the river are just totally coated with oil. A lot of the impact you can't really see because the oil is so heavy and thick that when it's on the batcher, it's covered over everything. So everything that it might have killed is under the oily layer. I saw a lot of oil birds that were a real concern all along the riverbank. But right now, the focus is on capturing as much of the oil from the river as it can. And then there's a few cleanup crews that are actually going along the batcher and sopping it up with pads.
Wilma Subra, there's much talk of allowing offshore drilling off the coasts of Florida and California, which has been banned since the 1980s. But offshore drilling has been going on steadily in the Gulf of Mexico along the Louisiana and Texas coasts. Do you think this huge oil spill, though it wasn't related to offshore drilling, will have any impact on that debate?
These types of accidents happen, and you see the huge impact of them. And, of course, Louisiana's offshore drilling is one of the largest in the nation, and we provide the resources to the rest of the country. And so this just demonstrates one more time the huge impacts that will come with additional drilling and production offshore.
You provide technical assistance to the Louisiana Environmental Action Network, and I know you're working with them on a policy paper in response to this bill. What can you tell us about that?
It's involving the federal and state agencies in the activities that need to be corrected to remedy some of the problems. To have the federal agencies and the state agencies determine the total impact on the environment and the economy from such a spill. Determine how well the cleanup will renew the environment back to the state it was in prior to the spill. There's also concerns about the drinking water sources, because as you know, from above New Orleans to the mouth of the river, those towns and New Orleans depend on river water as their drinking water source. And when you go out and look at the booms, they put booms up around all the water intake structures. But when you look at the booms, you see the oily mess on both sides of the booms. So there's an issue of was there any human health impact from the drinking water sources.
So this is going to be a really long-term cleanup project.
Absolutely. So that's one of our concerns, is not only for the Gulf of Mexico and the marshes, but along the banks and that ecosystem. And then our other concern is what happens when it gets into the Gulf, what impact will it have on the environment of the Gulf. We're the largest producers offshore, yeah. And most of the material gets piped or shipped onshore in Louisiana and then to the rest of the nation. And then we get the waste left in Louisiana for Louisiana to tend to the waste from all the production.
That was Wilma Subra, principal in the Subra Company, an advisor to the Louisiana Environmental Action Network. Contact Subra at area code 337-367-2222. 2216 or visit the Lean website at leanweb.org. A CBS News interview with Republican presidential candidate John McCain, conducted by anchor Katie Couric on July 22nd, has come in for some very harsh criticism for what the network chose not to broadcast. CBS editors inexplicably removed two statements in which the candidate made embarrassing factual errors. McCain falsely stated that the 2007 troop surge began the Anbar Awakening, a reference to the U.S. Sunni alliance that has reduced attacks in the province. CBS replaced the inaccurate statement with an answer McCain had given to a different question during the interview. Another instance of selective editing found CBS deleting a second false statement where McCain asserted that the war in Iraq was the first major conflict since 9/11, when in fact the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan was launched in October 2001 and the invasion of Iraq occurred in March 2003. The network responded to criticism by maintaining that the report was edited under extreme time constraints and one piece of tape was put in the wrong order. CBS News Senior Vice President Paul Friedman denied that the editing had in any way distorted what Senator McCain was saying. However, the group Media Matters for America has called on CBS News to broadcast the complete John McCain interview and inform their audience about their policy on editing interviews. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gioni Palmer, National Press Secretary with Media Matters, who discusses what many find so disturbing about CBS's decision to sanitize a presidential candidate's words on their national newscast.
Katie Couric asked Senator McCain a question, and his response, which did not make the air, he gave a false standing of the timeline in Iraq. He suggested that the surge, which he has made a focal point of his campaign and the success of the surge, he stated that the surge made it possible for the Anbar Awakening to take place, and that's when the sheikhs rose up against Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the insurgents and really began to push back. Well, in actuality, it was the Anbar Awakening that happened first months before the surge. But rather than reporting that falsehood on the part of Senator McCain, CBS News spliced an answer, essentially created a new answer for Senator McCain from other parts of the interview, including an entirely different question, and put that together in place of Senator McCain's false or incorrect answer. I mean, that's just wrong. That violates the most basic tenets of journalism. It violates the public trust. I used to be a newspaper reporter across the Long Island Sound working for Newsday, and if I ever did anything like that, I would have been fired. I mean, they basically made up, they spliced and diced an answer from elsewhere in the interview and supplanted that for Senator McCain's incorrect answer. That one is particularly glaring and offensive to anyone who believes in the basics of journalism, that what is reported is actually what is said. Now, there was another point where Senator McCain gave the response that the war in Iraq was the first post 9/11 conflict. Well, anyone who remembers history will remember that the conflict in Afghanistan, which is still going on, was in fact the first post 9/11 conflict. And taking it in its totality, I mean, those are particularly very glaring examples of, for lack of a better way to put it, CBS covering up for John McCain.
Now, as I understand it, CBS News basically said unapologetically that the edits that were made were not intentionally made to make John McCain look good or keep from the public his errors of fact, but instead were due to some careless editing unintentionally done with the time constraints of a network newscast. How much credibility does this CBS claim have?
I mean, it's not our job at Media Matters for America to kind of get into the psychology of the editors and try to understand why they may have covered for McCain, why or why not they may have covered for Senator McCain. Journalists often edit for space constraints. That's completely understandable. You could possibly argue that this would be okay journalistically not to have reported, at least in the first instance, Senator McCain's error. That's open to debate. I'd be willing to debate it. I'm sure you'd be willing to debate it, and many of your listeners would be willing to debate it. But that's not what they did. They created a new answer to supplement, to replace the incorrect answer that he made. And I don't know where in any journalism school or any newsroom in America where that is acceptable.
Do you feel the American people care about John McCain's apparent lack of basic knowledge on key issues in the Iraq War? Many of McCain's supporters basically say, you know, in the heat and tiring days of a political campaign like this, any candidate's liable to get their facts mixed up. So the context here of what he said or what he didn't say, how important is it?
I think it's very important. And, you know, look, particularly because the media has helped craft this narrative of John McCain as the sage when it comes to foreign affairs and the war in Iraq. And this is something that he has done, and particularly as these mistakes that he made came at a time that Senator Obama was traveling overseas, and members of the media themselves said that if Obama made a mistake or gaffe on the world stage, that it could and would be fatal. So that it's very important. Whether or not people understand it right now, I'm a little dismayed, but not entirely surprised that the mainstream media hasn't necessarily picked up on it. People don't like to write about themselves. Journalists writing about other journalists, I mean, that's writing about themselves. It makes them feel a little bit uncomfortable. That's why often institutions establish independent watchdogs or oversight boards to monitor the behavior, and that's why organizations like Media Matters for America are very important. That's why shows like yours are very important.
That was Gioni Palmer, National Press Secretary with Media Matters for America. Contact Media Matters by calling area code 202-756-4100 or visit their website at mediamatters.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.